So I was brought up by a phenomenal Christian mother in a Bible-believing home, but by the time I was about 11 years old, I started asking questions, lots of questions. And the church just kept answering, well, you just got to have faith. And that didn't work for me. You know, I had 20th century science and technology, junior high into high school, so I started calling myself a hypocrite. And by the time I didn't have to get in the car anymore and go to church or go to Bible camp, I didn't. And so by the time I graduated high school, I actually called myself an agnostic. I went to Georgetown, Oxford, and Berkeley, where I studied business, philosophy, and law. And by the time I came out of Bolt Hall here in Berkeley, I was a practicing atheist. I had totally walked away from anything spiritual. I'd done that part of my life. I was not even interested in asking the basic life questions anymore. And I marched to that tune for the entirety of the 90s. I was a corporate securities lawyer here in California, kind of toggled back and forth between Southern California and Silicon Valley. That was the heyday, right, of the dot-comers and taking companies public, doing mergers and acquisitions. And I lived a great life, making money. I did what I thought was the honorable thing with contracts. I was from a broken family, so I was going to, you know, never cheat on my wife. I believed in a kind of social contract view of the world that said if you're blessed with resources, you somehow had an obligation to give back to society. And I didn't need any notion of a higher power or absolute truth or anything to tell me that that just made sense. And so I did that through the entirety of the 90s, and I was generally happy. I didn't really need a supernatural crutch for anything in my life. Well, November of 1999, my mother was in a battle for her life with breast cancer and called me one day and she said, I got to go to an oncology appointment. Would you come and help me collect information? Because when you're going through chemo and such, they throw a lot of information at you, so she always have a second set of ears. Well, as the doctor was there with us and he kind of started talking about this trade-off between ongoing treatment alternatives and ongoing quality of her life, that pretty much they'd have tried everything, it just slapped me, man. And just, you know, the pit in your stomach where all of a sudden the questions of life came right back. You know, this was my precious mom. This was real pain. My mom was really going to die. And of course that rolled into, wow, there is purpose and meaning maybe in life. Wow, I am going to die. There are questions that need to be talked about, probed, and answered. And as an intellectual skeptic, that should be on the list. Why am I here? Where am I going when I die? The meaning, the purpose of it all. And so then I started a quest. I walked out of that oncology office, and I immediately went into a place of, I got to check this stuff out. I have to truly, as an intellectual skeptic, check this stuff out. So what did I do? I actually went back to where I was 20 years earlier. The high school level, what I had been taught about science and technology. And I started looking at the causation and the order, the design, the fine-tuning inherent in everything that we see, the digital code that underlies DNA, the irreducibly complex machines that are in us at the microscopic level or at the subsystem level of our brain, our heart, our lungs, our reproductive system. And I got to a place where I was looking at brain versus mind, subconscious. Why was I even thinking about this stuff? Why should it even matter if I'm just from a blob of goo? What is ethics? Why do I care about courage and altruism and love? What are emotions? And why do I even care about religion and these thoughts of God? Well, I got to a point in my journey where, wow, there is something out there. Something did it. You see, there's two starting points for every worldview. Something did it or it did itself. Something did it or it did itself. And I finally got to a place where, wow, something did it. Now, don't get me wrong, I was at a place where it could have been God or Brahma or Gaia, Mother Nature, even UFOs, but I was at a place where intellectually I couldn't go backwards, I had to go forwards. And right there, that day, my humanist, kind of naturalist, materialist worldview had to die because something did it. It didn't do itself. And so what I did was I went further and I said, okay, well, how have others in the last 5,000 years dealt with this question? I started reading the history books and the philosophy books, and the archaeology. I started reading these so-called holy books. The Bible was one of those books I had to read. You see, as a prideful skeptic, it's a perennial bestseller of all time. You got to read this book cover to cover, right? You got to say you read this book. So I picked it up for no other reason than intellectual pride, really. And I read that book cover to cover. And the first thing I realized is I was also reading the Analects of Confucius and Plato and everything else alongside was that the Bible was not a holy book. It wasn't a philosophy book. It was a history book. 66 separate books written by 40 authors over about 1,500 years. And I realized, wow, from Genesis to Revelation, this thing is tight. This is perfectly integrated. The symbols, the models, the types, the codes, the story itself is flawless. Now remember, I'm not reading this to somehow justify my belief. I'm doing this on a purely intellectually skeptical basis. And I got to a point where you couldn't do this with supercomputers. You couldn't get a bunch of people in a room and tie all this stuff together like it is from Genesis to Revelation. And I started looking at the historical prophecies. And I'm one of these guys that tested them all. And I started going, what is the probability that this book isn't somehow inspired from outside our space-time dimension? And I said, okay, what is this book that I'm reading? Where'd it come from? So I went through the manuscripts. You know, we have 25,000 manuscripts and fragments of the New Testament alone. We have about 7,000 of which are in the original Koine Greek. And when you compare all of these texts together, textual criticism now has brought us to a point where, but for about 40 lines of the Bible, we're reading exactly what was in place 2,000 out to 3,500 years ago. There is no question. What I mean by that is, you know, you get your Plato and your Aristotle, you get your Homer, you treat those as gospel truth in philosophy class, right? You know that the Iliad, there's only 643 copies that remain today of manuscript text, the closest one of which was 1,000 years after Homer wrote it. And we treat that like, oh, I read the Iliad in college, and that's all good stuff. 25,000 manuscripts and fragments of just the New Testament alone. Well, what does that mean? You got to compare apples to apples, right? And when you do so, you get to a point where, wow, this book is really special. And I went on to archaeology. Archaeology, until about 150 years ago, was really just treasure hunting. It wasn't even a soft science at all. People would just go in, grave rob, botch the things up, break things, and steal them. Well, within about the last 150 years, we've actually been able to manage and monitor archaeological digs. We broke the code on cuneiform, on Egyptian hieroglyphics. So it's a really exciting place to be. And whereas the enlightened people of Europe in the 18th century poo-pooed the Bible because they said, hey, the Hittites really didn't exist, and this King David and King Solomon really didn't exist, and if we don't have proof from them in archaeology, well then, we're going to question the reliability of the Old Testament. Well, wait a minute. Now we have proof of the Hittite culture. We've got extra biblical archaeological proof of Solomon and David. So shouldn't it flip back the other way? Again, I'm not, you know, this isn't a theological statement. This is just the people, the places, the events, the cultures, the battles. They happened. They were there. They were real. Genesis all the way up to Malachi, you had this recurring theme. Genesis, you had this Shiloh that would come. You had this Mashiach, this Messiah that would come. Isaiah called him Emmanuel, God with us. Job called him a Redeemer that would set foot on this earth. The whole story of the Old Testament is the New Testament concealed. And indeed, the New Testament is the Old Testament revealed. And I was having a really hard time, because remember, I'm an intellectual skeptic at this time, and I have to deal with this stuff. So I got to a point in my journey where, wait a minute, this book is something to be reckoned with. You couldn't do this. The probability of this story being told like this is too unreal. And so I got to a place of, I have to move forward. Now, at this time in my life, my wife picked up on this journey that I was going through. And she had been looking for a number of years a way to get me to go to church. So she did the, you know, we have two boys now, maybe a little moral upbringing would be good. Your mom, she's dying, it would mean a lot to her if she knew you were going to church. And so I gave in. My wife actually worked really hard at finding a church in Southern California at the time called Saddleback. Why did she pick Saddleback? Because I could hide. You know, it wasn't a small church where somebody was going to hold me accountable and shake my hand, and I could hide. I sat on the grass for 3 months. I would not go in because they were teaching me mythology and trying to take my money. But I was there for, you know, the reasons of, for my mom and for my kids. And I got to those prophecies of this Messiah, and I said, you know what? Is this Jesus guy for real? Did Jesus really fulfill the prophecies of this coming and predicted Shiloh, Messiah, Emmanuel? And I started, you know, for me, Jesus might just be a myth, man. He might just be a legend. So I dug in. You know, I've counted now to date 40 sources for Jesus. 40 sources for Jesus, 9 of which are the biblical texts. And please understand that that's phenomenal in and of itself. 9 separate ancient writers where 2,000 years later we can read those ancient texts. That's pretty phenomenal when you compare that to what was going on historically at the time. We only have 10 texts that mention the emperor of Rome at the time. So you see, you got to, again, compare apples to apples. Well, beyond those 9 biblical writers, I've got up to 40. And what I mean by that is Josephus and Tacitus and Pliny the Younger and all these different people that wrote about Jesus in a historical context within about 120 years of his death. Why is that important? Most of these people were not touting Christianity. Most of these people were just speaking, you know, in a historical sense. As a lawyer, that was huge to me. Why? Because a lot of times these people were actually anti-Christian. These people were actually writing on how do I persecute these so-called Christians? What are the rules of engagement? Who are these superstitious wackos? Nero, why are you lighting them up as human torches? Well, that's powerful for me as a lawyer. Why? Because if you want a great witness on the stand, your adverse witnesses turning testimony for you is very powerful. If you get your adverse witnesses to corroborate your story, it is very powerful. So that was very powerful for me, and I continued along. As I compared the history to the prophecy, and I got to this place of, wow, you know, 8 of those 9 writers, except for John, all gave their lives for this eyewitness story that they wrote? Why? Why would 8 out of those 9 writers, and most of the early believers in the early church, why would they give their lives? Well, it's easy. 9/11, we saw people dying for a belief in fundamentalist Islam. So what's the difference? So there's a huge difference. Think about it. Those people are actually dying for a belief. In the case of first century believers, what were they doing? They were dying for an historical event, not a belief. Today, martyrs die for a belief. But that first round of eyewitnesses, they died for an historical event. See, would a bunch of fishermen die to get their names in history books? If really all you had to do is just bend a knee to Caesar to save your neck, maybe one loony bin would do it. But would a whole conspiracy survive for nothing more than just an historical lie? No. Think of human nature. When life or liberty is at stake, it would not happen. So I finally put all this stuff together, and as an intellectual skeptic, I had to deal with this stuff. I was uncomfortable. This didn't make me happy. I wasn't trying to justify a faith that I was brought up in. But you know what? Truth is truth. Reality is reality.